Chapter 14. Green Revolution. For the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change. The fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 15. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late. President Barack Obama, 2013 State of the Union Address. One of the biggest challenges we face when it comes to ending wars is what President Dwight D. Eisenhower termed the military-industrial complex. When you drive out to the wealthy Virginia suburbs just a few miles from the Pentagon, you can find communities, both gated and open, but with private security patrolling the streets, with mile after mile of mansions, 10, 20, 30-bedroom affairs, with 6 or 10-car garages, and a house in the back where the butlers, maids, cooks, nannies, gardeners, pool man, and other servants live. These are the homes of the CEOs and senior executives and lobbyists for the military-industrial complex, which since 9/11 has added security to its name. Missiles, drones, and tanks, nerve gas, weaponized anthrax, and biological weapons, nuclear bombs, X-ray body/truck/building scanners, and electronics to spy on everybody from the Chinese to you and me, all built these homes. And the people who live in them get richer and richer whenever we march off to war. While there are, literally, millions of people who make their living off the war machine central to the American empire, the really big bucks are concentrated in the hands of a few dozen corporations and their suppliers. That consolidation makes them very, very powerful when it comes time to decide how much money to spend with phony AstroTurf Citizens for a Better America type of advertisements to either build up or tear down any particular member of Congress or candidate for president. Similarly, our power industries are concentrated in only a few hundred hands nationwide. Hub-and-spoke centralized power generation is how this country started, with George Westinghouse and Thomas Edison competing to see who would ultimately build the giant power plants from which tendrils of high-tension lines would supply entire cities with electricity. Westinghouse won the competition, by the way, because Edison stubbornly held on to direct current, DC, power, when the advantages of alternating current, AC, were so manifold. So there is only one power line going into your home, and it's coming from one power substation for your neighborhood, which is supplied by one giant power plant that's feeding a large chunk of your town. Grids and smart grids allow various power companies to share capacity and load, buying and selling electricity back and forth on the fly and by the second when necessary. But at the end of the day, you and I write a check to one company. That company is your local entry point into, or handcuff to, the power industrial complex. They like big. Big nuclear plants. Big coal plants. Big dams. Big oil or gas-fired plants. By keeping things centralized and big, they're able to ensure they can always, forever and ever, skim a few dollars out of your wallet every day for your electricity. Which is why it's such a good idea to decentralize our power systems. Decentralization. Big power is jumping on big solar and big wind projects like there's no tomorrow. They already have a business model that works for it. And to some extent, this isn't a bad thing. We have to make a transition from big coal and nuclear plants to something. And with the existing grid and distribution systems in place, these companies are ideally situated to be agents of that change. But what happens when a critical mass of people figure out they can live, like my friend Hal Cohen, without ever having to send a penny to a power company? Hal and Shelley live just outside Montpelier, Vermont, about as northern and mountainous a place as you'll find in America. They have a beautiful, spacious house with all the modern appliances and amenities, and there is no electric power wire coming to their house, and never has been. Hal's house is a more modern version of thousands built nationwide back in the late 1970s, when President Jimmy Carter had pushed through Congress a series of bills that made it profitable to build off-the-grid houses. He explicitly said, in an address to the nation in 1979, that his goal was to have 20% of the nation's power produced by solar energy by the year 2000. And with the programs he put into place, we would have easily reached it. Every time Louise and I move, which has been about every 5 years for the past 40-plus that we've been married, be it in Georgia, New Hampshire, Oregon, or Vermont, the realtors have always either had or known of off-the-grid houses for sale. And these houses were almost always either very recent or built between 1978 and 1982, when Ronald Reagan killed off the programs in a nod to his big energy financial supporters. The tipping point. If you type solar power rooftop shingles into a search engine, over 3 million hits come back. At the top is a 2010 video review that Consumer Reports did of Dow's new Powerhouse Solar Shingles, which the company was just then rolling out. They require no wires or wiring, and so can be installed by a normal roofer using normal roofing nails. They look pretty much like asphalt shingles, and protect the roof of the house the same or better. And they can generate from 40 to 60% of all the electricity a home needs. And that's assuming the home hasn't been super insulated and appliances haven't been upgraded to low-power consumption types. At the moment, according to Consumer Reports, it costs about $25,000 to cover your roof with Dow's new photovoltaic shingles. But federal tax advantages can cut that price by a third, and state tax incentives can drop it even further. Meanwhile, a new technology was announced in late 2011 that allows solar electric generating panels to be created using an inkjet printing technique to apply the light-catching-slash-electricity-producing material rather than the now-current gas diffusion method, which requires large machines, lots of heat, and wastes much of the material. The cost of solar panels is dropping like a stone, pretty much following Moore's Law. Every year or two, the price drops by half, while the capability doubles. As of this writing, solar panels are competitive with any other form of electricity generation, and far cheaper than coal or nuclear when you monetize the externalities such as fly ash, smoke/mercury, and nuclear waste. Wind is even cheaper. Both solar and wind will become so inexpensive soon, perhaps even by the time you hear these words, that the tipping point will have been reached, and most all of the investment, development, and research money and effort will be there, as will people's homes. Just as America now faces an unsustainable thirst for energy, so too was Germany faced with a power crisis in the late 1990s. Growing demands for electricity collided with the reality that the country has no oil reserves and a strong bias among its people against building new nuclear power plants in the wake of the nearby Chernobyl meltdown. Yet the government knew that the country needed the electricity equivalent of at least one or two nuclear power plants over the next decade. So, how to generate that much electricity without nuclear power? In 1999, progressives in Germany passed the 100,000 roofs program, which mandated that banks had to provide low-interest 10-year loans to homeowners sufficient for them to put solar panels on their houses. They then passed the Renewable Energy Law and integrated the 100,000 Roofs program into it in 2004. The REL mandated that for the next 10 years, the power company had to buy power back from those homeowners at a level substantially above the going rate, so that the homeowner's income from the solar panels would equal their loan payment on the panels and would also represent the actual cost to the power company to generate that amount of power by building a new nuclear power plant. At the end of the 10 years, the power company gets to buy solar power at its regular rate, and it now has a new source of power without having to pay to maintain and eventually dismantle a nuclear reactor. In fact, while the reactor would have a 20 to 30-year lifespan, the solar panels typically last 50 years. For the homeowners, it was a no-brainer. They were getting low-interest loans from banks for the solar panels, and the power companies were paying for the power generated from those panels at a rate high enough to pay off the loans. It was like getting solar power panels for free. If anything, the government underestimated how rapidly Germans would embrace the program, and thus how much power would be produced by the program, and how quickly. By 2007, Germany accounted for about half of the entire world's solar market. Just that one year, 2007, saw 1,300 megawatts, millions of watts, of solar-generating capacity brought online across the country. For comparison, consider that the average generating capacity of each of the last five nuclear power plants brought online in the United States is 1,160 megawatts. In 2008, Germany added 2,000 megawatts of solar power to their grid, and in 2009, homeowners and businesses put onto their roofs enough solar panels to glean an additional 2,500 megawatts. Although the goal for the first decade of this century was to generate around 3,000 megawatts, eliminating the need to build two new nuclear power plants, this simple no-risk program had instead added over 8,500 megawatts of power. And because the generation sources were scattered across the country, there was no need to run new high-tension power lines from central generating stations, making it more efficient and less expensive. Meanwhile, as dozens of German companies got into the business of manufacturing and installing solar power systems, the cost dropped by more than half between 1997 and 2007, and continues to plummet. The Germans expect that by 2050, more than a quarter of all their electricity will come from solar. It's now just over 1%, adding to the roughly 12.5% of all German energy currently being produced by renewable energy sources, mostly hydro, but also including wind, biomass, and geothermal. The solar panel program has been so successful that the German government is now thinking that it's time to back off and leave this to the marketplace. As the New York Times noted in May 2008, thanks to its aggressive push into renewable energies, cloud-wreathed Germany has become an unlikely leader in the race to harness the sun's energy. It has by far the largest market for photovoltaic systems, which convert sunlight into electricity, with roughly half of the world's total installations. Now, though, with so many solar panels on so many rooftops, critics say Germany has too much of a good thing, even in a time of record oil prices. Conservative lawmakers, in particular, want to pare back generous government incentives that support solar development. They say solar generation is growing so fast that it threatens to overburden consumers with high electricity bills. Translation: the solar panel manufacturers want the subsidies to stop so they can catch up with demand and then bump up the price and profits. Because of the subsidies, prices have been dropping faster than manufacturing costs. Germany is now considering incentives to its world-famous domestic auto industry to manufacture flex-fuel, plug-in, hybrid automobiles that can get over 500 miles per gallon of strategic gasoline, boosted by domestically produced rooftop solar with existing technology. Meanwhile, Denmark has invested billions into having more than half of its entire auto fleet using only electricity by 2030. And China is no slouch when it comes to renewable energy. Although the Chinese continue to bring another dirty coal-fired power plant online about once a week, they surpassed every other nation in the world in 2010 in direct investment in the production of solar and wind power, as the Los Angeles Times reported in March 2010. U.S. clean energy investments hit $18.6 billion last year, a report from the Pew Charitable Trust said, a little more than half the Chinese total of $34.6 billion. 5 years ago, China's investments in clean energy totaled just $2.5 billion. The United States also slipped behind 10 other countries, including Canada and Mexico, in clean energy investments as a share of the national economy. The Pew report pointed to another factor constraining U.S. competitiveness, a lack of national mandates for renewable energy production, or a surcharge on greenhouse gas emissions that would make fossil fuels more expensive. The ultimate power to the people is for homes to have their own solar roofs, no longer needing power lines from distant power plants owned by big transnational corporations. A few countries are pushing this solar tipping point, like China and Germany. Jimmy Carter started us in this direction a generation ago, but Reagan and the Bushes paused it, and we've never recovered. Ironically, if our government doesn't participate in bringing along the tipping point to solar and other renewable energy systems, it'll happen anyway because of the strong demand in other nations that is driving the technology to be cheaper and more easily accessed. The only downside for us will be that, like with our clothes and computers and TVs and pretty much everything else except weaponry, we'll be buying our solar panels from overseas. The final point, which I also noted in my book Rebooting the American Dream, is that if we don't strip oil of its strategic value, we will continue to be at the mercy of OPEC, which comprises more than a few nations that don't much like us. Stripping oil of its strategic value. 200 years ago, and for 1,000 years before that, one of the most strategic substances on Earth was salt. It was strategic because no army could travel without it. Salt was necessary to preserve food in a pre-refrigeration era. Wars were fought over it, and countries that had lots of salt made out well, while landlocked countries with no salt reserves were forced to sell their natural resources in exchange for it. Oil is the new salt. It is now the planet's number one strategic resource, and as has been noted by numerous commentators since the first Gulf War in 1990 to 1991, if the primary export of Iraq was broccoli, we wouldn't have given a damn that Saddam Hussein was a tin pot tyrant. The unfortunate reality is that we have within and around our national boundaries about 3% of the world's oil, but we consume about 24% of the world's produced oil. So we buy what we don't produce. This dependence represents a massive transfer of wealth from us to oil-producing countries. It's a strategic blunder that would have horrified Julius Caesar, who expanded the Roman Empire all the way to Central Europe when he ran out of fuel, wood, by deforesting virtually all of Italy, and then paid the price as his empire began to collapse from overexpansion. The most conspicuous consequence of the deforestation of Italy during the early years of Caesar's rule was the currency crisis, in which the cost of refining the silver used in Roman coins doubled, because the cost of the wood used to fire the smelters more than doubled. Some historians argue that this moment, when Rome could no longer supply its own energy needs, was the first signal of the beginning of the end of the Roman Empire. Interestingly, 1970 is widely accepted as the peak oil year for the United States, when our domestic oil supplies began an irreversible slide and our imports began to shoot up from 10 to 20% into the 50 to 60% range, where they are today. Then President Richard Nixon called for an alternative energy strategy to get us off oil, and President Jimmy Carter actually put one in place in 1978. But Ronald Reagan rolled it back in 1981, leading directly to a dramatic increase in our imports of foreign oil. Countries like Saudi Arabia rake in billions from oil-dependent countries like the United States, and oil revenues fuel their economies. In 2008, for instance, Saudi oil revenues spiked to $281 billion, a quadrupling of revenues from 2002. In 2009, those fell sharply to $115 billion. Still nothing to sneeze at. Oil revenues fund much of the fundamentalist Wahhabi movement within Saudi Arabia, and it's out of this movement that come the most virulent anti-American and anti-Semitic rhetoric, textbooks, and television and radio programming. 30 years ago, the OPEC nations were producing around 30 million barrels a day, nearly half of the world oil consumption. Regardless of how much we buy from them, or instead buy from Mexico, because oil is a fungible commodity, their production will continue and just go to others, who are no longer buying from whoever we choose to buy from. The proof of this is that today OPEC production is still around 30 million barrels, even though world oil consumption has gone up and is now around 85 million barrels a day. The OPEC nations don't adjust production to meet demand. They maintain it to control prices, so they have relatively stable income. Thus, the only way we can change this situation is to reduce the amount of oil we use. Oil is a strategic commodity, and we need to strip it of its strategic value. So what do we use all that oil for that makes it a strategic resource? We certainly don't use it to produce electricity. Only 2% of our electricity is generated by oil, because we have huge domestic supplies of coal, which produce over half of our electricity. Pretty much nobody is producing electricity with oil except the oil-rich countries of the Middle East. Even rapidly growing countries like China and India, for example, are not producing oil-fired power plants. Thus, moving to solar, wind, biomass, or even nuclear power to generate electricity in the United States will help tremendously with our CO2 output and all the pollution externalities associated with coal. But it will not make us less oil-dependent or strip oil of its strategic significance. The simple fact is that oil accounts for roughly 95% of the energy used for transportation in the United States. Our military is the world's single largest consumer of oil, and that's what makes it strategic. If we want to strip oil of its strategic value so it can't be used as a weapon against us, and so we can use our remaining oil supplies for rational things, such as producing plastics and medicines, we need to shift our transportation sector away from oil, and do so quickly. This has been the essence of T. Boone Pickens' rant, although the eccentric oil billionaire is now a natural gas billionaire, and he's suggesting that we convert our truck fleet in this country from oil to natural gas, which is nearly as bad a source of greenhouse gases as is oil. He's right that such a change would make us stronger and safer, both militarily and strategically, but he misses the global warming part of the equation, which is also increasingly becoming a strategic issue, as global climate deterioration leads to crises both at home and abroad. Europe, Japan, and China are moving fast to shift their transportation sectors from oil to electricity, mostly through the use of trains. Brazil did it over the past 20 years by mandating that all cars and trucks sold would have to be flex fuel, capable of burning gasoline or ethanol, diesel or biodiesel. The result is that Brazil now provides nearly half of their transportation needs with domestically grown ethanol, made from sugarcane. Over 80% of their cars and trucks are now flex fuel. And the added cost to Brazilian drivers to buy a flex fuel car instead of gasoline or diesel-only car? About $100. China is similarly moving in the direction of flex fuel cars, and doubling every year their methanol production, mostly derived from domestically produced coal. Flex fuel cars can also burn part ethanol, part gasoline. If, for example, we were to shift to only 20% of the fuel being used by a car being gasoline, the remainder being ethanol or methanol, then a single gallon of gas would go 5 times as far. A 40-mile-per-gallon car would become a 200-mile-per-gallon vehicle in terms of the strategic resource of oil-derived gasoline. Most significantly, in the United States, fully half of all automobiles are driven fewer than 20 miles in any given day. This is an easy range for an electric-only or a plug-in hybrid car, and by moving to the latter immediately, mandating them, we could shift the entire U.S. auto fleet to consuming 50% or more electricity instead of gas/diesel in less than a decade, stripping oil of half its strategic importance. And our trade policies are really stupid on this. We have no import tariff whatsoever on oil, so there is nothing to discourage American drivers from using foreign-produced oil products to fuel their cars and trucks. But we charge an import tariff of over $0.50 a gallon on ethanol, discouraging Americans from using the fuel and discouraging the more than 100 countries in the world where there's enough intense sunlight and where sugarcane grows well from becoming net fuel exporters. And while we offer billions in tax breaks and incentives to oil, gas, and coal companies in the United States, we don't subsidize or support with tax subsidies, as the Danes are doing, electric or part electric cars, either in their production or on the consumer end. If we add to all of this some good scientific innovation in developing a mix of low-carbon energy resources, biomass, geothermal, wind, tidal power, and so on, and can figure out a way to strip the carbon dioxide out of our power plant smokestacks and our atmosphere and turn it into a solid, calcium carbonate, which you can buy at the store under the brand name Tums, is a good candidate for a desirable product produced by binding carbon, in this case to calcium. It's not inconceivable that by 2050, we could cut our CO2 emissions by over 80%, and perhaps even decades sooner if we begin now. Plus, we could strip oil of its strategic value and make our nation independent of Middle Eastern dictatorships. Tipping point reached. A new study by the research firm Bloomberg New Energy Finance has found that unsubsidized renewable energy is now cheaper than fossil fuels, such as coal and gas. In fact, it's a lot cheaper. Data show that wind farms in Australia can produce energy at $80 per megawatt hour. Meanwhile, coal plants are producing energy at $143 per megawatt hour, and gas at $116 per megawatt hour. Unlike the United States, where energy companies can pollute and have the costs from illness to environmental degradation picked up by the taxpayers, Australia has a carbon tax, which partially explains why renewables have a price advantage. But the data show that even without the cost of the carbon tax factored in, wind energy is still 14 cents cheaper than coal and 18 cents cheaper than gas. And this is in a nation that relies more heavily on coal than any other industrialized nation in the world. But that coal reliance will soon change, because companies in Australia are quickly adopting new, cheaper, renewable energies. As the study found, banks and lending institutions in Australia are now less and less likely to finance new coal plants, because they've simply become a bad investment. And while Australian wind is cheapest now, by 2020, and maybe sooner, solar power will also be cheaper than coal and gas in Australia. The energy game is rapidly changing in that country. Michael Liebreich, the chief executive of Bloomberg New Energy Finance, noted, "The perception that fossil fuels are cheap and renewables are expensive is now out of date." Well, here's a newsflash. That perception has been out of date for a while now, even right here in the United States. According to the Energy Information Administration, looking ahead to 2016, natural gas is the cheapest energy in the United States at roughly $66 per megawatt hour. Coal comes in second at $94 per megawatt hour. But right behind coal is renewable wind at $97 per megawatt hour, which in large part accounts for why U.S. wind energy production has tripled since 2000. And unlike in Australia, none of those U.S. prices account for the externalities associated with fossil fuels, consequences such as pollution, cancers, the need for military protection, or global warming. In America, the fossil fuel industry has made sure those externalities are paid for not by the coal and gas energy producers, but instead by you and me. The fossil fuel industry doesn't pay a penny of the cost of rapidly accelerating climate change, or the healthcare costs from exhaust and refinery-driven diseases and deaths from air, water, and other pollution. Not to mention the community costs of decreasing property values when a coal plant is put in your backyard. Nor do they put a cent toward the cost of our Navy keeping the oil shipping lanes open, or for our soldiers protecting the countries that produce all that oil. All of these externalities come with fossil fuel production, but pretty much don't exist with renewable energy production. And those externality costs are not only not paid for by the fossil fuel industry, they're never even mentioned in the corporate-run news media in America. Research from the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences concludes that the total cost of these externalities, if paid by the polluters themselves, would raise U.S. fossil fuel prices by as much as nearly $3 per megawatt hour. And that's an extremely conservative estimate, which puts wind power on parity with coal in America. The trend lines here are pretty clear. Buggy whip, meet automobile. Renewables are getting cheaper, and fossil fuels are getting more expensive. Which is why we as a nation need to throw everything we have at making renewable energies our primary way of powering America into the 21st century. Think of it as a new Apollo project. We need green energy, local energy, and a 21st century smart grid to handle it all. Over time, the marketplace could do this, but markets are reactive, not active. With just about every developed country in the world ahead of us, and our dependence on oil making us more and more tightly bound to Middle Eastern dictators and radicals, to wait and hope that big transnational corporations will help birth a new America is both naive and stupid. Instead of depending on them, we should be recovering from them the cost of their externalities, with a carbon tax that can be used to build that new energy infrastructure for America. Let's take a lesson from Australia and the Eurozone, which have both set up carbon taxes to make 19th-century energy barons pay for at least some of the damage they've done, and then use that revenue for a green energy revolution here in America. The way to get there is known. The products are available. The pressure is growing, from climate change-induced disasters to a growing recognition that transferring $1 billion a day to other countries and big transnational corporations to buy oil is no way to live. In January 2013, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a massive solar power facility comprising over 33,600 individual solar modules capable of producing 13.1 gigawatt hours of electricity every year was turned on. It's big enough to power 1,200 homes, but will be used to power a Volkswagen manufacturing plant. And it's the biggest solar installation ever built in the state of Tennessee. Also, the United States just surpassed Germany as the number two country in the world when it comes to producing wind power. The largest wind farm in the world, the Alta Wind Energy Center, is located right here in the United States in Kern County, California. The Department of Energy estimates that 20% of our national energy could be produced by wind come 2030. After the crash of 2016, we must move forward with new energy. Chapter 15. Democratize the Economy. The few own the many because they possess the means of livelihood of all. The country is governed for the richest, for the corporation, the bankers, the land speculators, and for the exploiters of labor. The majority of mankind are working people. So long as their fair demands, the ownership and control of their livelihoods, are set at naught, we can have neither men's rights nor women's rights. The majority of mankind is ground down by industrial oppression in order that the small remnant may live in ease. Helen Keller, 1911. I got picked up in a cab by a lawyer. I was in Madison, Wisconsin, to speak for the second year in a row at the Fighting Bob Fest, where about 10,000 progressives from the upper Midwest have gotten together every year for the past decade, at the suggestion of Jim Hightower, and organized by Ed Garvey, to celebrate the memory of progressive Republican Fighting Bob La Follette. I gave one of several keynote addresses, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, Cornel West, and Greg Palast, among others. But this year was different from previous years at Fighting Bob Fest. The new governor, Scott Walker, had launched his attack on unions, sparking hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites and other supporters of unions from across America to gather on the lawns of the Capitol in Madison in protest. With the unions mobilized, recall elections were launched against several Republican state senators and were successful against two, nearly tipping the balance of power in the state Senate back to the Democrats. Soon, a recall campaign would be launched against Governor Scott Walker himself. So there was an incredible energy among progressives in Wisconsin that year, one that was most palpable at the Fighting Bob Fest. But it was when I was being shuffled around the Badger State by taxicab that I caught a whiff of true progressivism at work. It was on a ride back to my hotel that I encountered an economic model that could be our nation's savior after the great crash of 2016. The Silent Revolution. There's something just below the surface that most of us are unaware of in America. While the all-powerful profit motive dominates the global economy, there's a new and very far-reaching economy that's sprung up in just the last few decades that's trying something different. It's the cooperative economy. Currently, 1 billion people around the world are members of cooperatives. While each cooperative is run differently, they all have the same characteristic: democracy in the workplace. There is no all-powerful CEO determining the pay for himself and his workers. There is no secret board of directors looking out for the best interest of unknown shareholders. A cooperative is managed and owned by its workers. Usually through a small fee, an employee can buy a stake in the co-op and be part of the decision-making process. One person, one vote. As business gets better, the profits don't go to the very top. They are spread among the workers, incentivizing everyone to work harder and sell more together, hence the name cooperative. In communism, everything is owned by the entire state, by everybody. That is a profound and radical difference from co-ops. Worker-owned co-ops are arguably a form of capitalism, where workers hold the capital in individual companies. With communism, the state controls the means of both supply and distribution. And 1 billion people around the world rely on cooperatives, from people banking at credit unions to farmers joining together to sell their crops as a cooperative enterprise. Not only that, the United Nations estimates that 3 billion people, nearly half the global population, has been positively affected by a cooperative enterprise. It's no coincidence that cooperatives are popping up so frequently and having such an impact around the world at this particular moment. In his book, America Beyond Capitalism, historian and author Gar Alperovitz refers to the emerging cooperative model as the new way forward in a global economy that has witnessed state socialism fail and is now witnessing corporate capitalism fail. I had a conversation with Gar, and he told me, warning about the impending failure of corporate capitalism, "There's either another way forward over the long haul, or I think we're in for real trouble and decay. And decay is what we're seeing." The rest of the world has already seen that decay and has moved toward co-ops. In 2001, Argentina went into an economic crisis after it told the IMF to get off its back and defaulted on its $132 billion foreign debt. Suddenly, the world's seventh largest economy at the time collapsed. A quarter of the population was unemployed. The middle class disappeared into the working poor class. People went hungry and turned desperate, leading to a surge in violence and crime. And many of the 1% fled or moved their money and assets offshore. I was in the nation's capital, Buenos Aires, in September 2002 to give a speech. I was staying with friends in an upper-middle-class part of town, Palermo, and the crash was beginning to resolve. The looting of the previous year was over. The new president was stabilizing the country. The peso was becoming stable. But the unemployment crisis was still very, very real. One of the clearest memories I have of that time and that visit was of driving down the streets of this nice neighborhood and seeing in front of every third or fourth house a pile of furniture, or TVs, or tools, with a for sale sign and price. People were selling their belongings just to pay for food and rent. With no one able to buy their goods, factory owners in Argentina had shut down in search of new consumers and new workers elsewhere. Collapses aren't good for business. This was a nation that had seen its social democracy overthrown and replaced by a corporate capitalist system. And that system had just imploded and hit rock bottom. The country was now desperately searching for a new way forward. And they found it right in front of their eyes. In the weeks after the crash, the people began returning to the now empty and gutted factories that they had worked in before the crash. Initially, they just started sleeping there, hoping they'd be first in line to work should the CEOs ever return and open up shop again. But that never happened. And then they just started working on their own. They fixed up the machines, elected a small commission of people to coordinate the work, and went right back to manufacturing stuff. Through democratic procedures, the workers decided how they would spend the profits, first paying off the debts the factory owed to get it back on its feet, then spreading the rest out in salary among themselves. Since then, the cooperative model has flourished, and Argentina is again a thriving economy less than a decade after the crash. Today, there are 16,000 cooperatives in Argentina, employing 300,000 people and making up 10% of the nation's GDP. One out of every four Argentinians does business with a cooperative, and thus has some sort of say in how money is spent in the economy. Gar calls this democratizing capital, which is taking the flow of money, whether it's workers' wages, reinvestment, or profits, and putting it up to a vote among those who are most affected by that money, such as the workers themselves, the customers, and the community. That's different from corporate capitalism, in which the CEO or a small board of directors and shareholders exclusively makes the decisions about capital. For decades, our economy has felt the pain of corporations deciding to close millions of factories and send tens of millions of jobs offshore. It has been polluted by millions of tons of toxic gas into the atmosphere and ground and water that have poisoned entire cities, and it has been victimized by theft, as 100% of the excess profits made thanks to 40 years of automation and increased efficiency have gone to corporate executives rather than paid to workers through higher wages and more leisure time. Given all of this, democratizing capital sure seems like a damn good idea. Not only that, cooperatives can be just as competitive in the global market as transnational corporations. The Dragon's Mountain. There's a small town in Spain, nestled away in the shadow of a mountain that used to house a vicious dragon. It's called Mondragon, and it's home to the largest cooperative federation in the entire world. That dragon, now long extinct, was likely a brutal lord or local king who terrorized the people of the small town during the feudal Dark Ages. But now, as the United States and other Western economies descend into a form of neo-feudalism with predatory transnational corporations terrorizing labor around the world, Mondragon is a beacon of hope for a new capitalism. Back in 2009, Louise and I visited the town that lies in the shadow of the mountain, as well as the Mondragon Cooperative, which employs more than 90,000 people in more than 250 different companies focused on retail, finance, industry, and knowledge. In 2008, Mondragon's revenue was $24.2 billion, and every single penny of profit was either reinvested back in the business, given to charity, or paid as dividends to Mondragon's worker owners. Unlike the top-down nature of most capitalistic businesses, and even communism, Mondragon and other cooperatives have flipped the pyramid upside down. There are no CEOs making 2,000 times more than the average worker. There is no board demanding higher and higher profits and pushing for offshoring. There is no contract with an outside acquisition firm, such as Mitt Romney's Bain Capital, to trim the fat. The workers are trusted to determine the best direction for their company, for themselves, and for the economy. I saw firsthand how decisions are made at Mondragon as I stood on the spotless factory floor of a washing machine manufacturing plant within Mondragon. All around me, worker owners at the state-of-the-art industrial facility were converting sheet metal into finished washing machine parts and assembling electronics to go in those washing machines on a U-shaped assembly line. That's when a manager walked up asking for everyone's attention. He notified his colleagues that the following Thursday there needed to be a schedule change due to a local event, and therefore a different number of units would have to be produced. Rather than giving new orders regarding how the workers were supposed to deal with the change, he ceded his authority to those on the assembly line and asked, "How do you think we should do this?" Then a conversation took place. The workers offered suggestions, critiquing the strengths and weaknesses of each idea. There was no arguing or complaining or fighting. It was an exchange of ideas, with the manager listening attentively as though he was actually the one who was being told how things would change next Thursday. 10 minutes or so passed, and a consensus was reached on how the factory would adjust. The manager thanked everyone and walked off, and the machine and conveyor belts were turned back on. It was true democracy in the workplace. But cooperatives are just one way of democratizing capital. Germany has another way. The Mercedes and the Labor Union. When the American auto companies were on the verge of failure following the financial crisis of 2008, the Obama administration moved to bail them out. Conservatives were outraged. Mitt Romney, in particular, called for letting the American auto industry go bankrupt. Since most of the American auto plants employed unionized workers, a bankruptcy would have allowed the companies to renegotiate union contracts and pensions, thus continuing the right-wing assault on unions. At the time, the economic royalists argued that American auto companies were failing, not because they were getting destroyed in the market by better quality cars made overseas, or by irresponsible free trade policies, but instead because they were paying unionized workers far too much. In today's global economy, the royalists insisted, workers had to take pay cuts so that the corporation they worked for could be more profitable and more competitive in the global market. You can call it the growing pains of globalization. But is it true? Do American workers really need to lose wages for the sake of our economy? Not if we just do what Germany is doing. In 2010, Germany manufactured 5.5 million cars. The United States manufactured less than half that, just 2.7 million cars. So, according to the logic of the economic royalist, Germany must pay their auto workers jack, right? Actually, Germany paid their auto workers about $67 an hour, including wages and benefits. But the United States paid its average worker only $33 an hour, also including wages and benefits. On top of that, German car manufacturers were highly profitable, despite the comparatively large paychecks of their workers. BMW earned a before-tax profit of 3.8 billion euros, and Mercedes-Benz hauled in profits of 4.6 billion euros. So how did Germany just completely blow up the royalist myth that car companies have to pay their workers less to be more profitable and manufacture more cars? How can Germany do the opposite, pay their workers more, be more profitable, and make more cars? The answer? Democracy. First, Germans have completely democratized the auto plant by unionizing nearly every single auto worker in the country under IG Metall, the German Auto Workers Union. With such a high union membership rate, auto workers hold a lot of sway when they threaten to go on strike. That's how workers have been able to keep wages high and working conditions satisfactory. But as Horst Mund, the head of the International Department of the German Auto Workers Union, pointed out, unions hardly ever go on strike in Germany, because there is an elaborate system of conflict resolution that regularly is used to come to some sort of compromise that is acceptable to all parties. One reason for the more collaborative relationship between CEOs and workers is that, unlike in the United States, unions aren't under attack, and there aren't any right-to-work-for-less zones in Germany to which car manufacturers can flee so they can ignore the voice of organized labor. Another and perhaps more powerful reason is that there is a constitutional amendment in Germany that forces corporate executives to listen to labor unions. The Works Constitution Act requires every factory to set up a works council that gives representatives of the workers a seat at the table in every decision-making process at the factory. That is the democratization of capitalism, expanding the decision-making process to not just the corporate elite, but the entirety of the company, from the bottom up. This, according to Mund, is the real reason why the auto workers' union has a loud voice in the German economy. Pointing to the adversarial relationship between employers and labor unions in America, Mund says, "The accusation that American unions are more radical and destructive definitely has to do with the hostile environment in which the unions have to act. How can they be constructive and friendly if their asses are kicked all the time?" He goes on to say that without the Works Constitution Act in Germany, employers would not talk to us either if they had the choice. But, intentions aside, the empowerment of labor unions in Germany and the democratization of the workplace through an enforced constitutional amendment has been an economic boon for Germany, as demonstrated by car sales, employee wages, and profitability. As Mund concludes, "We have strong unions, we have strong social security systems, we have high wages. So if I believed what the neoliberals are arguing, we would have to be bankrupt. But apparently this is not the case. The economy is working well in Germany." So how do we democratize capital in the United States and give workers more of a say in how our economy is run? And why, if a $24 billion cooperative venture can be successfully established in the remote Basque region of northern Spain, can't such a massive venture take hold here, in the big cities of the world's wealthiest nation? The seeds. Compared to the rest of the world, we're falling behind. As Rebecca Campbell, the president of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, told me, the U.S. is probably the smallest and most insignificant part of this international movement. But the seeds are there. Madison, Wisconsin, seems like any other Midwestern town at first glance. It's the state capital and a college town. So, having grown up in Lansing and East Lansing, Michigan, I figured it was pretty much like home. Until I got into the cab, a couple of times. The company is called Union Cab, and one of my drivers used to be a lawyer. Another used to teach college. Another was a high school graduate who loved what he was doing and considered driving a cab an art form. He was also a pretty good tour guide. And these people had actually worked to get out of their old jobs and into driving a cab. Why is that? Why the heck would people leave seemingly very lucrative jobs to sit behind the wheel of a cab all day? So I asked the general manager, a guy named John McNamara, exactly what makes his cab company different from all the rest. The answer is that they all belong to a cooperative. The basic story, he told me, really goes back to the late 60s, with both the anti-war and the social justice and civil rights movements. Cab drivers were organizing into unions in response to the political climate of the day, but weren't making any headway to better wages and working conditions with their bosses. When the unions went on strike, the owners just shut down the companies. After one strike in particular, and subsequent shutdown in 1978 against the Checker Cab Company, the drivers decided to give starting their own cooperative cab company a shot. It was a lot of hard work, and the first winter was really bleak, McNamara told me. But around the same time, the bus drivers' union went on strike, and the fledgling co-op lent out a few cabs to the out-of-work bus drivers. It really helped launch our company, he said, and business has been good ever since. McNamara himself ditched going to graduate school in 1988 to join the Union Cab Co-op. I was bartending in a bar where a bunch of cab drivers would stop by, and I heard about Union Cab. I wanted to see what it was like to work in a worker-owned company, he told me. It was a great fit with my worldview. To find a company whose culture and worldview matches my own, especially since I was coming from totally left of center, was really amazing. It was like being home. When I visited in 2010, Union Cab had about 220 people working for it. That's 180 drivers plus mechanics, a call center staff, an IT department for dispatching, and an administrative staff. The entire operation runs a bit over $6 million a year. It's the only cab company in the state that gives health insurance to its drivers, who are some of the best paid in the country. We have drivers who've come to this company literally homeless and have managed to buy homes, McNamara told me. One of those homeless people is now driving a BMW. We're head and shoulders above our competitors in how we treat our workers, and that translates into the service we give our customers. I talked with one of the drivers, Fred Shepartz, about how Union Cab is different from the rest. The industry as a whole is exploitative and corrupt, and it's getting worse, Fred said. Cab industry in Milwaukee is more and more like a sweatshop, with a lot of immigrant drivers who are more desperate than we are for work. Unlike Union Cab, the rest of the cab industry isn't set up for the drivers to make money. It's set up for the owners to make money, Fred told me. He gave me an example of one of the other cab companies in town that uses the standard sole proprietorship model, in which the owner is in the business of making as much money for himself as he can, and he does it by exploiting the hard work of his drivers. He takes $1.50 off the top of every ride a driver does. He pays his drivers a commission, but that $1.50 is not commissionable. He presumably makes that choice because it makes his company more money. But at Union Cab, you don't have to work 60 or 80 hours like so many other cab drivers have to do. You don't leave work with your soul sucked out so badly that you can't do anything else afterward, Fred told me. I get a 52% commission. I have health insurance, and my wife is on the policy, and that's literally been a lifesaver, as she's had major and minor surgery over the past few years. Working in a workplace where every single person has a say and every single person is a vital piece of the whole company is a totally different experience. With fewer hours and better pay, most of the drivers at Union Cab can pursue their other interests. While working as a driver, Fred has published several short stories, with his first novel published 4 years ago entitled Vampire Cabbie, about a 1,000-year-old vampire who loses his money in the stock market crash of 87. At the time I talked to him, he was working on another book, Solidarity Moon, about a labor struggle on the first colony in a star system. I ended up living it instead of writing about it, he told me. We have a number of musicians who have put together 2 CD compilations of their music. We have artists. We have 3 published authors. So people are able to pursue other things in their lives because we do allow people to make enough in a normal 40-hour work week that they can also do other things. Unlike the big banks on Wall Street and the same transnational corporations that line main streets across America, Union Cab isn't run by the profit motive. As John McNamara told me, we don't want a huge profit at the end of the year because that means you didn't pay your workers enough. But can a company not exclusively motivated by profit be able to compete and do well in the market? Absolutely. Union Cab is the largest of the 4 cab companies in Madison. It has the largest fleet and the best service. It has an employee retention rate of 85%, and most workers stay there beyond 5 years. In fact, Union isn't alone. There are 9 other successful cooperatives, from bakeries to engineering companies to pharmacies, within 5 miles of the state capital, employing over 400 people and doing more than $30 million in business a year. In fact, a lot of Americans have endorsed cooperatives in recent decades, thus laying the foundation for an entirely new economy to replace the one that will be in tatters following the crash of 2016. We think that giant transnational energy corporations dominate the energy market, but in reality, cooperatives do. More than 900 rural electric cooperatives deliver electricity to more than 42 million people in 47 states. There are roughly 30,000 business cooperatives in the United States, running 73,000 businesses and owning more than $3 trillion in assets. They bring in $500 billion in revenue and pay $25 billion in wages to 2 million workers in every sector of the economy. Despite falling behind the rest of the world, Rebecca told me, it feels like we're on the edge of a huge explosion in the sector, and we're working to build the capacity to support that. The crash will be the trigger. Chapter 16. Epilogue. A Letter to My Great-Grandchildren. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1937, Second Inaugural Address. In 2090, you live in an interesting time, much like the one I'm alive in right now and my children are experiencing with some ferocity. After the progressive revolution that followed the crash of 2016, the conservative neoliberal laissez-faire economics championed by Reagan, Greenspan, and Milton and Tom Friedman was so discredited that, like the last time it was discredited in 1929, it pretty much went underground. Ayn Rand and her bizarre writings were viewed as crackpot and ignored. The democratic socialism, which had already been largely adopted by Japan, South Korea, Australia/New Zealand, and many South and Central American countries by 2016, was finally accepted by Americans as the only viable way to have both a vibrant and, perhaps most important, stable economy, and at the same time have an uncorrupted democratic form of governance. Semi-protectionist trade and manufacturing policies were adopted. Energy independence was achieved during the first few decades after the crash, and taxes were raised on the economic royalists, and their behaviors in the political arena were restricted by constitutional amendment. So for another few generations, much like in the era of 1935 to 1980, their ability to control governance was limited, and their ability to crash the economy again was stopped. That lasted from roughly 2016 through about 2066, much like the 50-year period after the crash of 1929. But then your generation's Lewis Powell, Jude Winiski, Milton Friedman, and ultimately Ronald Reagan emerged. Your generation's very wealthy, your equivalent of our Koch brothers and Walton heirs, found people to draft policy papers, invent institutions, write novels, and busy themselves in the political arena. Your Federalist Party, which grew out of the ashes of our Republican Party, after its internecine wars with its billionaire-funded Tea Party faction, began to convince people that the social safety net that had kept our nation stable and secure for two generations was a terrible thing. They argued that too much money was going to the lower rungs of society, particularly those they suggested, oh so subtly, were genetically and intellectually inferior. Those people should know their place, and it was ridiculous, they said in the 2060s, that everybody should enjoy basic levels of safety and security in society. After all, they said, without the threat of homelessness and illness, why would they ever bother to get out and work? Of course, what all that rhetoric hid was the Federalists' efforts to shift wealth and power, particularly political power, from the rabble, as Federalist John Adams called the working classes, to the economic royalists themselves. Steadily, steadily, through the 2070s and 2080s, they cut away at the social safety net. And just like Warren Harding in 1921 and Ronald Reagan in 1981, your Federalist politicians put in place policies, from huge tax cuts on the economic royalists to dilution of the anti-corruption laws passed in 2016 to 2017, that cut the economic and political power of average working people and shifted it to the corporate and inherited wealth elite. If you'd looked back at our history, from the eras of the cotton kings in the 1850s to those of the robber barons of the 1900s, the economic royalists of the 1930s, and the republicans of the 1980s, you'd have seen the beginnings of the process. The front men for the economic royalists, you call them the Federalists, we call them the Republicans, during Lincoln's era he called them secessionists, were busy as termites gnawing holes through the policies that had kept them in check for two generations. Through that third generation of the 2060s and 2070s, nobody much noticed, although the political rhetoric had taken on a harder edge. By the 2080s, they had pretty much seized control of most state and federal legislative and judicial bodies, and they had the economy roaring white hot, making the top 1% richer than any kings of old before the crash that happened in 2090. Learn from history. With the invention of the cotton gin and other steam-operated machinery, Our economy in the American South had exploded in the 1840s and 1850s. Same with the banking industry in the American North. And then they all collapsed in the Great Crash of 1856, which led to the Civil War. While our economy had been largely based on slavery before the Civil War, we built our way out of it with the Industrial Revolution and the use of coal and oil for power instead of the muscles of slaves. But that, too, got taken over by the economic royalists in the 1920s, leading to the Great Crash of 1929. Out of the ashes of that crash, America was rebuilt by the New Deal, whose cornerstones were high tax rates on the royalists, unions for the workers, and a well-informed electorate thanks to the Fairness Doctrine, which required radio and TV stations to give free time to political candidates. All three of those pillars began to disintegrate during the 1980s with Reagan, leading to a generation of hot bubble economies, just like you were experiencing before your crash. After our crash of 2016, we built our way back to prosperity by using alternative energies, building a national transportation and energy infrastructure, and stripping the economic royalists of their ability to pursue so-called free trade policies that not only decimated our nation, but those we traded with as well. We shifted from Reagan's laissez-faire economics to the regulated economics of the founders, of Lincoln, of FDR. And we built large community and national-based cooperatives as alternatives to raw capitalism, with workers having ownership stakes in the businesses for which they worked. You, too, are now facing an economy in ruins and a world in turmoil. Climate change has altered the face and economy of every nation on the planet, and your generation of economic royalists figured out how to profit from it, watching the trends and carefully buying and selling lands and businesses as people were forced to move from areas where deserts were on the march into areas that had become more habitable than before. But they overreached, ending up owning too much in too few hands. And so, just like in all the cycles before, you and your children are paying for their greed. Learn from our mistakes and from what we got right. You won't have novel new power and economic stimulants such as steam, the way Lincoln's generation did. You won't have oil as a new resource, the way Teddy Roosevelt's generation did. You won't have unions, the way Eisenhower's generation did. And you won't have the explosion of an alternative energy economy, the way my children's generation did in the years after the Obama administration and the recovery from the Great Crash of 2016. But there will be something new in each of those areas. Looking forward from 2013, as I am now, I don't know what it will be. But the one thing history, over 10,000 years of the history of civilization, tells us is that it will be something. Use it. But be very, very careful that in doing so, you don't hand your generation of economic royalists another tool they can use to once again rise up like lords and kings to take control. Keep it decentralized. As Thomas Jefferson urged at the founding of our nation, keep both power and economic strength local and broadly based. That will keep political power local and broadly based as well, which is the surest way to have stability going forward into the future. A pyramid standing on its base is stable, although unlike the Egyptian pyramids, the pyramids of economics and political systems are made of stuff that changes from generation to generation. Agriculture and human/animal power, coal and steam power, oil and industrial power, solar and cooperative power. As you make the transition into a new world and a new economy, rising out of the ashes of the crash your generation of economic royalists brought you, always remember that they will still be there. They'll be watching and planning and grasping for the levers that will bring them back on top. Be careful, and, as Dwight Eisenhower warned my generation in his farewell address, be ever vigilant against that misplaced power that they are seeking. It's unlikely that you'll be able to stop altogether the rise of the economic royalists during the lifetimes of your children and grandchildren. They've always figured out a way to pull it off, all the way back to the era of Gilgamesh, 7,000 years ago in Uruk, what we now call Iraq. but please do your best to send a warning to your future generations. Don't do like we did with Reaganomics and blow up the protections for your working people. Don't jump into the equivalent of our Clinton-Gingrich-Greenspan experiment of deregulating the institutions owned by the economic royalists. Tell your children and ask them to tell theirs. Maybe, just maybe, you and your peers can break these cycles of history, stop the boom-bust-war merry-go-round that this nation and the world has endured for more than half a millennium since Elizabeth I chartered the East India Company in 1601. Because just as democracies will always have economic royalists looking for ways to subvert them to their own ends, they will also always have people who remember the lessons of history, people who know the possibility of a stable world at peace, people willing to sacrifice and work and put themselves on the front lines of history to build a better world. Find them. Celebrate them. Become one of them. Tag. You're it. This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America, and What We Can Do to Stop It. Written by Tom Hartman. Read by Dan Warren. Produced by Dennis Kale. Directed by Fred Sanders. Post-production by Jeff Thomas. Production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America, and What We Can Do to Stop It, is also available in print and digital formats from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2013 by Tom Hartman. Audio production copyright 2013, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.